This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to explore a World War II story that I never get tired of hearing. We're talking about the late Louis Zamperini today because the film Unbroken, Path to Redemption is about to hit theaters nationwide. It opens September 14th. A red carpet event will take place September 15th with three different showings that include a chance to mingle with Louis's son Luke, as well as actors from the film. Samuel C. Hunt, who plays Louis, will be there, as will Bob Gunton, who I'm sure you remember as the warden in The Shawshank Redemption, and who now has found another redemption story to be a part of. That red carpet event will be in Fresno, California, where Louis once competed in the famed West Coast Relays as a record-breaking runner for the University of Southern California. You'll hear more about the new film in a bit, including what Laura Hillenbrand, the author of Unbroken, has to say about it. But for now, let's go back 75 years to May 1943. He somehow escaped that sinking airplane, but when he came to the surface as one of only three initial survivors out of a crew of 11, he had no idea he'd be spending the next 47 days floating on a raft.
So there's two or three of us down in the raft. The tail gunner, within 30 minutes, he starts screaming, we're going to die, we're all going to die. And that was pathetic. And I turned to him and said, look it. Nobody's going to die. We'll be rushing this afternoon or tomorrow or the next day. It settled down, Mac, and he wouldn't settle down. He kept screaming, so I tried to use psychology on him. I'd taken a course in psychology at USC, Psychology 51. It didn't work. So I threatened him. I said, when we're picked up, I'm making a report to the commander, and you'll be in real trouble. He kept on screaming. So I turned my back on him, and I came around with a backhand on my knuckles. I cracked him across the face and knocked him on his butt, and he just lay there in complete contentment. He had a half smile on his face. A week later, or 5 days later, I had to do the same thing again, and after that, no problem. In fact, he got better and better as we went along instead of worse and worse. I thought if anybody hallucinates, it'll be him. But we buried him on the 33rd day, and he was sharper than he's ever been in his life. We had a program of mental exercises every day during the whole trip of 47 days. And our minds kept improving more and more. In fact, we were sharper after 47 days than we were the day we crashed.
Well, and this is unbelievable, and I know you lived it, and you've told the story so many times, and you just described it. But I'm imagining myself as someone who doesn't know your story and hearing this, and I want to highlight here some of the things. There were 11 men on your crew. Three of you survived initially, and you just said 47 days. You had to survive for 47 days lost at sea. How did you do that?
Well, the will to live. Now, I have a lot of young people say, well, did you ever think about dying out there? I said, not once. We never talked about dying. We only talked about living. And that fortified our constitution, you see. And then we had every day without telling them, I would come up with mental exercises like memorizing songs. Okay, I would teach them the hit top 40 songs. Dad was a minister. He'd teach us the words to the songs in the hymnal book. Mm-hmm. And every day we'd have some exercise, thinking back as far as you can think. And what are you going to do after the war? Every day we had something to keep our minds occupied, because my professor at SC, Dr. Webster, told us in class that the brain is like a muscle. Unless you exercise it every day, it will atrophy.
Now, so you told your crewmates the day that you crashed that, yeah, we'll be rescued tomorrow or later today. You survived 47 days hoping to be rescued by friendly forces. It's the Japanese who end up finding you. They're interrogating you. You've gone from 165 pounds to 65. Yet it seems like the way you describe it now, you woke up every day energized to make it to the next day.
Right. Well, we had a strong will to live. There was no problem out there. We never thought about death or even talked about it. On the 27th day, that was our worst day on the 27th. That's when a plane flew over. It looked like a B-25 American plane. We shot flares through what had died in the ocean. The plane came down real low. We took our shirts off. We were waving at them. And we knew we'd be rescued. And then we heard machine gun firing, and the bullets went right between our legs, and one hit the metal pump on one raft, and it tore the whole bottom of the raft out. 12. We only had one raft, three of us in that raft. Actually, 48 holes in that little raft, and none of us are touched by a bullet. You talk about another miracle, that was it.
Amen.
That went on for 30 minutes of strafing, and then they finally opened up their bomb bay doors and dropped the depth charge. That depth charge missed us about 50 feet, which would have killed us, but it failed to explode. So the bombardier improperly armed the bomb, and so fortunately we lived through that. And then it was a miserable time trying to patch that raft to keep it afloat because it was wrinkled, laying flat in the water, two sharks around us, and we had to keep pumping, and bubbles kept coming out. And then we just put as many patches on the top as we could, and then we got it in pretty good shape, and then we had to patch the bottom. Now, that's a trick. The raft is in two pieces. There's two tubes. So we let the air out of one half, pulled it up, let it dry, and tried to put a patch on it while we're sitting on the other half. In the meantime, there's always two sharks, always two of them. I don't know why they don't come in threes. And they were coming up trying to get us from the rear. So the tail gunner's job was to have an oar, and he would jab them on the nose. There's something about a shark's nose that they don't like. As a matter of fact, they found out last year a great white, when they stuck his nose out of the water, they touched it with their hands and he became docile. The trick is to get him on the nose, and so that's what I did underwater. I straight on the sharks, two of them, while the strafing was going on, and when I'd hit them on the nose, they'd take off. But they come back because they're still hungry. So the raft, we got in pretty good shape. We only had to pump up once every hour. And then, of course, Mac died on the 33rd day. I was surprised he lived that long.
I know that your time's limited, Louie, and I don't want to accelerate you too far here, but you end up as a prisoner of war of the Japanese. And this is incredible to me as well. One of the gentlemen who ended up interrogating you was one of your USC classmates?
Yes. He said, when you were entering USC in 36, I was graduating. He was on the interrogation panel. Then an officer from another division on Kwajalein, he followed American sports and USC football and the Olympics. And so he came to the panel and said, instead of executing, our day of execution was already set. And anyway, he said it would better serve Japan's purpose to send him on to Japan to make propaganda broadcasts. Well, it made sense. I said, hey, great idea. So we got to go to Japan. And then, sure enough, they asked me to make a broadcast to my parents, which I wrote. And then they said, oh, you have beautiful radio voice. We want you to make another broadcast. At this time, they wrote the script, and it was propaganda, and I refused. And I think that's what Laura meant by being unbroken, on the raft and unbroken here, because then they had me severely punished on a daily basis because I wouldn't make the broadcast, and then they finally sent me to a slave labor camp, and I still wouldn't give in. And the war ended there at Camp 4B in Nowetsu, about 35 miles from Nagano, where the Olympics were held.
Yeah, and there's a story there, too. And now you talk about that first broadcast that you got to make for your parents' benefit. Now, at that time, they believed that you had died, right?
Yeah, but the broadcast was so scrambly, the government wouldn't accept it as me. My parents were pretty sure it was me because I mentioned a few items that only they knew, but it was so incoherent that the Army said, no, there's no proof that he's alive, and so they kept me dead.
Wow. This is Louis Zamperini. He mentioned Unbroken. That, of course, the title of the best-selling book by Laura Hillenbrand, who also wrote Seabiscuit and another fast finisher in Louis Zamperini, her newest topic. His book is Devil at My Heels. Louis Zamperini, full of life, and obviously you had to be to survive everything you did. You're captured in July of 43. Of course, the war doesn't end until 1945. More than 2 years in captivity. What was the hardest thing to endure that the Japanese did to you? What was the toughest thing for you to overcome?
Everything. On a daily basis, I'm beaten, and so I have to keep as far away from Watanabe, the bird we called him. And so I'm in a barracks with about 70 other men. So I always stayed in the back of the barracks because they come in for inspection. Two guards come in first and holler, Chef K, and so you come to attention. And then the bird does whatever he does. So he comes in. I'm way in the back. He came in, and he looked around for about 5 or 7 seconds. He kept looking around for me, and he saw me. And he hollered, you come to attention last. Well, he looked around for a long time before he said that. And I didn't come to attention last, but he wanted to work me over. So he called me up. He had a big web belt, about 3/8 of an inch thick, and 4 inches wide and a 1 pound steel buckle on the end, a big, big buckle. He took his belt off and hit me across the forehead, knocked me to the ground. Now, I don't go down easily, but I'm laying there bleeding, and then he took out a piece of toilet paper and he handed it to me, and he said, "Oh, like, I'm sorry." And I said, "Well, he can't be that bad." So I wiped the blood. I stood up. I took the tissue, and I pulled it away from my head to look to see how much blood was on it, and he hit me again in the same spot.
Oh.
This time I stayed down. But I got that, you know, that was almost on a daily basis, the beatings from him. I guess they gave word somehow that because I refused to make the broadcast on Tokyo Rose's program, that I was to be punished repeatedly. So I took a beating there, and then I thought, well, if I go to a slave labor camp, I'll get away from him. But they transferred him a week earlier. Now they have 100 camps in Tokyo proper. And they sent him to the very camp that I came to, so I had to put up with him again.
Holy moly.
And again, he threatened my life over and over again. And he said, if I draw my sword, I must use it. That's Sumerai law, you know. And then he had me take care of a sick goat. The goat was dying. He says, the goat dies, you die. Well, I knew the goat was going to die, and he did too. When the goat died, he took me outside and called everybody out, all the prisoners, hundreds. And I'm standing out there alone, and then he walks back and forth with his hand on his sword. The goat die, you die. And then finally he got two guys to bring over a big 4x6 cherry wood log, which is heavy, about 6-8 feet long. And he made me hold it over my head. Well, I held it for 10 minutes that I can remember, and then I went numb. And Henley Wade from England, he had a watch, and he timed it 37 minutes. I couldn't believe I held it that long, but I wasn't conscious of holding it after the first 10 minutes.
And if you've seen the film Unbroken, released just after Louis' passing in 2014, that may be the scene you remember the most. Those are the kind of memories that would end up triggering PTSD after the war, and things that still proved heavy when Louis first read the best-selling book about his life, as we hear from Louis' daughter, Cynthia.
Even when our father was reading the book, he waited 7 years to be able to read Unbroken, and he was so excited to get an advanced copy. And he said, you know, I called him days later and asked him, how was it? And he hardly had any words. He said he had to keep putting it down and looking out to remind himself where he was, because the book was so detailed to put him emotionally right back there.
And no one described the emotions, good or bad, quite like Louis Zamperini himself. Here's how he described his liberation from that Japanese prison camp on Hometown Heroes.
Well, that was it was a beautiful day. We were suspicious. You see, there's always rumors the war's over, so we didn't believe anything. But this one guard came to me and he said, a horrible thing happened in a city called Hiroshima. A cholera broke out, and nobody can communicate with Hiroshima. And I thought, cholera, my God, how horrible. I'm glad we're hundreds of miles north. That was the first atomic bomb, and the Japanese lied to the public.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the second bomb was dropped, they told the truth immediately because they had no choice. So that ended the war, and then a plane flew over, and we wrote PW on the roof. They circled left, and then the bird disappeared. He knew the war was over before we did. He skipped out and hid out in the mountains for 10 or 12 years. In the meantime, a TBF flew over from a carrier, and sent us the Morse code in red light, that the war was over. And we were in the river for the first time swimming. We always wanted to go in that fresh water to clean ourselves. They wouldn't let us do it. But then the day they let us do it, I thought, well, maybe the war is over. So anyway, we came out of there, and the TBF dropped a long red streamer, and we picked it up, and on the end was a candy bar with a bite out of it and a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette missing. We had to divide both of those up with several hundred men. We had to form circles, and one cigarette. Everybody takes one puff, and so it goes around the circle. It was really funny, but we were serious. And then the chocolate, we got a little teeny sliver just to taste it, and that was it. Now, Commander Fitzgerald of the Perch submarine, he was in command, a highest-ranking officer with us, and he made sure that everybody got one puff of a cigarette and a little taste of the chocolate. And then, of course, the B-29s came over and dropped tons of food on us, and And instead of hating the guards, they were complaining about their families starving at home. So we gave them a lot of food from the bombers.
Well, your stomachs probably couldn't take that much anyway.
The commander warned the guys, you know, you haven't been eating good food. You've been eating seaweed and barley for years, and so take it easy on the food. Well, some guys were so hungry, they just, pea soup was supposed to be diluted with a can of water, and they would eat it straight. So some guys got diarrhea from that, but the smart guys just ate a little more every day until they got used to it. I took my time coming home, by the way. I got fattened up, and I was back to a normal weight by the time I got to San Francisco. And that's another story, the repatriation. You could do another book on that.
I believe it. Maybe you should.
Anyway, I went to hell and almost got killed on the way home. You know, there was a bomber. We were supposed to fly to Manila, but socked in. I'm leaving Okinawa now. I'm gradually working my way home. We were told to land at Loag, a small city in northern Luzon, on a fighter strip, stayed there all night. Next day, they gave us clearance to go to Manila, and we took off with this bomber full of about 40 prisoners inside, and the runway's too short. There was a berm on the end of the runway that they put there to keep the ocean from flooding the runway, and I was up there between the pilot and co-pilot, and I knew we weren't going to make it, and they did too. We hit the berm, bounced in the air, and settled so low that the white caps came through the bomb bay doors and got all the prisoners wet, and I thought, this is it. After all I've been through, I'm dead. And then the plane gradually pulled up. We got to Manila. A couple of years ago, I got a call from a fellow in the East, and he asked me how I got to Manila. When I told him about that bomber taking off, he said, well, I was the pilot, and I almost went in my pants. So, yeah. Anyway, that's really funny. Yeah. So, anyway, I got home, and of course, the big celebrations, and I had a ball, and then I finally got married.
And in all the attention deservedly given to Louis, his wife, Cynthia, often is relegated to unsung hero. But the actress who plays Cynthia in Unbroken, Path to Redemption, is excited to highlight the role of a committed and resilient wife in Louis's post-war transformation. Merritt Patterson has the privilege of portraying Cynthia.
And the first movie shows the beginning of his life, and it shows the war, and it shows the prisoner of war camp. And then that's kind of where it ends. This movie is a great opportunity to show the next part of his life, and it was a huge, huge important part of his life. I mean, what happened after the war was life-altering for him, and it was a struggle. And I think people want to see that. And I also think that going through what he went through and struggling with PTSD and alcoholism, not only can people relate to that, but also the fact that he's able to come out of that. There's hope there. And he goes through some incredible struggles, and he's able to come out the other side with his wife. It's just a really great story, and I think people deserve to see that side. And they didn't know each other that well before they got married, so they go through a lot of trials and tribulations, and the story is really about them and their love for each other and their relationship and working through a lot of these issues, and eventually that brings them to faith.
And that faith would be the element of his story that Louis Zamperini was the most intent on sharing, and sharing passionately right up until his passing at age 97 in 2014. The Reverend Billy Graham, by the way, is portrayed in this new film by his grandson, Will Graham. Unbroken, Path to Redemption opens nationwide September 14th. When we come back, a few more of Louis's own words about what he dealt with after World War II, and then Laura Hillenbrand, author of Unbroken, on the impact Louis has had on her personally and what she thinks of the new film. Watch the trailer or link to more info online at hometownheroes.com. radio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.